Hi, this is Peter Bogdanovich, and I'm going to be talking with you as we watch Targets. This picture began with a phone call from Roger Corman telling me that Boris Karloff owed him 2 days' work, and that I was to use 20 minutes of footage from a picture he'd made called The Terror, and that's what you're seeing right now, is footage from a sequence in The Terror, a movie that Roger Corman directed and produced in the 60s. And this entire credit sequence, which lasts for, a couple of minutes, actually was the final sequence from The Terror, but I shortened it from about 20 minutes to about 3. There's Frank Marshall listed as assistant to the director. This was his first picture, as it was my second that I worked on. The first was The Wild Angels. And Verna Fields, who became a very famous editor, she was the sound editor on this. All the action sequences were shot silent. Anyway, this, there's Jack Nicholson in not one of his great roles. He plays a French legionnaire. And anyway, this sequence is part of what I had to use from The Terror, and I was trying to figure out how to incorporate this footage into a new movie about Boris Karloff. Edited this myself on a Moviola down to what you're seeing here. By the way, Laszlo Kovacs' credit, you just saw this, was his first film where he took that credit. He'd shot some other films, but he always used the name Leslie Kovacs. He said he wouldn't use Laszlo, which is his real name, until he liked the picture, and he said he liked this one. Polly Platt and I did the story, but Samuel Fuller, the well-known director, writer, producer, did a major rewrite for me in about 3 hours, pacing back and forth in his living room, and refused to take credit for it. But he contributed a great deal. Some of the stuff I'll tell you as we go along. So the idea for that Karloff should be an actor in this movie actually came about from a joke, which was that I was going to begin the picture with The Terror. The lights were going to go up. Roger Corman was going to be sitting next to Karloff, and he was going to turn to Roger and say, "That's the worst movie I've ever seen." And then I realized that wasn't a bad idea, the idea that Karloff would be an actor, and that's what gave me the beginning of an idea as to how to use Boris Karloff in this. And the way you see Boris, here he is, dear Boris, the way you see him in the movie is very much the way he was in life, very kind of dressed that way, although I think we bought him the shirt, but as I remember, it's my jacket. It's a low-budget picture. And but the way he looks is very much the way he looked. And this was made only about 2 years before he died. There's me, my God, looking like a child. And Nancy Shea, who I had met on John Ford's Cheyenne Autumn. The Sammy Fuller's idea to have the secretary be Chinese. And I remember Nancy. Monty Landis and Arthur Peterson, both very good actors. This was all shot in a little studio in Santa Monica Boulevard. Great film, eh, Jenny? And we converted this set into other sets later. Everything was rebuilt all in a couple of days.
Thank you very much. No, I'm serious. This is a very important film. This is the kind of problem.
My name in the movie, Sammy Michaels, is a little tip of the hat to Samuel Fuller, whose name is Samuel Michael Fuller.
What? What, Byron?
I'm retiring.
God, it's great to see Boris. Anyway, he was very much like this character he plays here. Plays a famous movie star, famous for horror movies, and only Boris never thought about quitting, never thought about retiring. That wasn't his cup of tea.
Not at all. I think Sammy directed it very well.
Now, I edited this film myself. That's why there's no editor credit. And I remember sitting in a moviola on Sadakoy Street, which is the name of the production company we used.
Please, Marshal.
Because it was Sadakoy Street where I was living with Polly Platt. That's my first wife. We shot everything you see with Boris Karloff in 5 days and nights. So I was playing a young movie director writer in this, and of course that's what I was at the time, a young movie director writer. I remember we bought these costumes, went down to Beverly Hills to get that shirt and the sweater, I think.
What if he goes back to England?
There was a whole thing about the color scheme in this picture. All the colors in the Karloff sequences were purposely warm colors, like the yellow, which I never wear, and brown and beige and all warm colors, red. And all the colors in the other story, the Bobby Thompson story, the killer, are cold colors, blue and white and so on. That was done very purposely, having learned about color coordination from talking to George Cukor and the way he did A Star Is Born. This was shot on Sunset Boulevard, right on Sunset.
Don't be his errand boy, it nauseates.
I didn't come out here because
I know you came out to save your
life. And this little shot here was all one piece. In fact, that shot of me coming out the door was the very first shot we made in the entire picture. The first day of shooting, and I was late, and the limousine hadn't shown up. I was late because I was looking at a location and got lost in the valley. And I got there, and they told me, I broke my watch, and then they told me that the limousine wasn't there yet, hadn't showed up. So we had to shoot me first coming out the door. It scared me to death. And this is all one shot, and now it cuts. This was Sammy Fuller's idea, this line, let them have it. And then you cut to this, which was done across the street. And in fact, this was Sammy's idea of the eye, the trigger, and so on. That was his the way he started the sequence for me. And this was shot in what was really a gun shop, which doesn't exist anymore, but it's right across the street from that little building, which still is on Sunset Boulevard. And this was, again, everything you see with Boris was shot in those 5 days. I don't know how we did it. The actor playing Bobby Thompson is a fellow named Tim O'Kelly. I believe he only made one or two other pictures. He loved this experience. This was, I just cast him. I thought he looked like the typical American boy. He looks a little like Ryan O'Neill, as a matter of fact. He was superb in the movie, and then he did one other picture. Then he disappeared. I don't have any idea whatever happened to him. People always ask me because he's so good in the picture. And I don't know. What happened? I think he dropped out.
Here, don't forget your receipt. Oh, thanks. See ya.
Anyway, that's what it said, the gun shop. This was real. And there's Sunset in all its glory. And the parking lot was there that you see. We did this whole picture for about $125,000, which includes $25,000 for Boris. So we did it for about $100,000. And that shot of the trunk was to scare you and show you we were up against something here. And this was the first day of shooting with Boris. And that was really in the limousine. That's not a rear projection. We were sitting with him. And Boris was so wonderful to work with.
No fun anymore.
I didn't meet him till the day before. We'd spoken on the phone a few times, though. And he said to me one point, he says, since I'm obviously playing myself in this movie, he said, could I not say so many terrible things about myself? And I said, the audience will like you better if you put yourself down. Well, whatever you think. Anyway, this was shot on the freeway. Now, you're not supposed to shoot on the freeway. You're not allowed to shoot on the real freeway. But the Roger Corman guerrilla warfare technique is such that you have to just do whatever you're not allowed to do. And there was a clear day going down in the valley, very rare to see that. It just rained, so it was clear. And those gas tanks are still there. But we shot all this illegally. In the car and shooting the car from outside. All this was done illegally. You weren't supposed to do this. And it was done at speed. And that shot, for example, and the next one that you're going to see was from another car, a truck pulling away. And there in the background you can see the Reseda Drive-In where we the last sequence plays. All of this stuff was done without permission. We got away with it. I can't remember how we did. I think we did the camera on the hood of the car. This was done at the Reseda Drive-In, which no longer is there. And, yeah, that's all gone. Interesting, the colors are yellow and blue, which are the two colors of the movie. Just luck, dumb luck. This was a real house in the valley that Polly and I found. She did the production design. And Mustangs had just started coming out. There was a new car at that time, so it's kind of unusual to have a white Mustang. I think they'd only been on the market for a couple of years. I remember this shot, it troubling me as being seemed like it was too long, but it turned out all right. Now, this whole sequence inside the house here, this is not the real house you walked into. This was shot in a studio. And the same sets that we used for Karloff were all rejuggled. The walls were rejuggled and repainted because we didn't have any money and made to look like his house. This terrible icy walls and so on. I remember you'll notice there's no score in the picture. It's all just what you hear, live sounds and a radio, TV, whatever's on. And so here we play almost this whole sequence is played on him walking around his house as though he's a stranger in it. Makes him a little odd. And you hear a lot of talk about where's Bobby and so on. Now that shot tells you he was in the army. It's the only shot you see in the entire picture. And very few people picked up on that. But he's supposed to have been in Vietnam. And that was the only clue to it, was that one shot, which is, and that shows that they were married somewhere in Hawaii, maybe. You heard the trailer for Anatomy of a Murder playing on television. That's one of my favorite movies, Otto Preminger film. Now, this is all one long shot, long take, that whole thing from the father coming in. This all plays in one shot. And there's a lot of overlapping dialogue, which we had to rehearse and so on. And you only hear the radio playing. And this is kind of a Norman Rockwell image here, that terrible painting in the back. And the decision not to use music, only to use source, was based on an idea that I got from Hitchcock's Rear Window, where he did the same thing. It gives a feeling of verisimilitude, feeling that we're not commenting on the action. Here's the only cut in the sequence. And now this is supposed to be the Polo Lounge, and we couldn't afford to get any wider than this, because there was no more set, except this, and then for the side angles you can see a little bit of the next booth, but it was supposed to be the Polo Lounge. Of course we couldn't afford to go there. So Polly did a good job of faking it. You can see there's not even any set behind him. There's just black drape there. This actor, Arthur Peterson, playing a press agent, his character is based on some press agents I'd met by then, because I've been writing about movies since the late 50s, early 60s. Met an awful lot of press agents. And I met a couple that were a lot like him. It was because of this sequence that the editor whom I hired, who worked on the picture for about a week, was fired. Because he had cut this so badly. He cut it like a race sequence, or like a kind of a action sequence was so badly edited that I had to reorder all the dailies and start over again. And I fired him and decided to do it myself. As I had cut my own sequences on Rogers' picture, The Wild Angels. It's funny, there was a couple of wider shots in this which we took out where you actually Sal Mineo came in and did a little guest shot for me. But it didn't work. The set didn't look good enough. This was so much based on my brief experience with show business, movies. I mean, I'd been acting, of course, since I was 15, so knew a little bit about this. Hemingway used to say, write about what you know. Well, I was trying to. The character of Bobby Thompson, the boy, the sniper, boy who turns killer, was based on a real incident that happened in Texas about 2 years before. Charles Whitman went up to the Tower of University, University of Texas in Austin, and shot a bunch of people.
He's going to sue you, you know. And he'll win.
I've got a little money.
So here we are telling basically two stories, the Karloff story and the killer story, Bobby Thompson's story. And there's two different color schemes, as I already said, and also the transitions were very important. So it was very important to go from one sequence to another in a way that it would tell the audience exactly where we were. So this cut that's coming up was a planned shot cut, so you know that you're somewhere else and you know who you're with, since it's about guns. This was shot out in the valley. The character, the boy's character here, Bobby's character, was, as I say, based on Charles Whitman, who also was an average American kid, and didn't like his father, evidently. There wasn't that much we knew about him, because he killed himself, Charles Whitman, before he could be arrested. And he was, of course, a little bit in the Norman Bates department, because he was very kind of, we wanted him to be very average. Here's a dolly shot moving in on him to give you a sense of some impending disaster. And a lot of the time we show the picture from the killer's point of view, like here. And that was a technique that Hitchcock, of course, uses brilliantly, the subjective. That's Laszlo Kovacs's hand holding the rifle there, and the camera. He was operating. Laszlo was the only time that I worked with him. I worked with him about six times. The only time he actually operated the camera as well as did the lighting, and held the gun for that shot. He did it again in What's Up Doc for one shot. We remembered together that he'd done it before. Now we go to the high angle here to throw you off a little bit. And now here we are. This is supposed to be the Beverly Hills Hotel again. We faked it. And we weren't even allowed to shoot outside the Beverly Hills Hotel. So, but this is definitely patterned after one of their bungalows. And then you see the warm set, warm colors.
You don't have to go on being my secretary, you know.
I know.
I don't want to break up a romance.
Boris was very much prepared. He knew the lines. He always referred to the dialogue as the lyrics or the jokes. It was one of the, I know the jokes. I have the lyrics. I have the jokes. He never called them the lines.
Tired of your baleful looks.
Is that why you're trying to pick a fight with me?
Well, I always thought Karloff was a wonderful actor, but I really wanted to see him. That was one of the problems we had, was trying to figure out how to make him a villain or a heavy in this picture. when we came up with the idea that he would be an actor who wanted to retire because he felt that the kind of Victorian horror that he was used to doing was outdated. And now in this, you see, the close-up is of her and the medium shot is of him to put, make him, sort of make her, make it shown from her point of view, so to speak. He's in the medium shot, she's in the close-up.
There are one or two of us who care what happens to you, though I can't imagine why.
But he was wonderful to work with. He was so prepared, so ready, so... We didn't have to do many takes with him. Just one or two, usually.
Tom? Good evening, Mr. Orlock.
It was all very easy with Boris. As I said, we did it all in 5 days, so... Couldn't do very many takes. Now, this is a pan. It pans over to the table in a moment. And, that we knew we were going to be cutting to a panning shot.
Thank you, sir.
In the boy's house. So that was, again, part of the plan. I think that's how it goes. And you see how warm the set is. We pan over and there's the two, service for two. Which now he's alone. And then we cut to a pan there, you know. So it continues the scene. Now, this shot was probably the most ambitious shot in the entire movie. It began on that panning shot you saw from the door and goes to this. Now, that everything you're hearing was Joey Bishop was doing a talk show on ABC, on Channel 7, on ABC, opposite Johnny Carson. And we got permission from Joey Bishop, and the guy who was talking to Joey Bishop is Regis Philbin, who was Joey Bishop's announcer, you know, partner on the show. This shot, as I say, began way back on the pan, goes to the scene in the video room, followed him in here, and continues without a cut. It's almost 5 minutes, this shot. And it was the most difficult shot in the whole picture in terms of acting and getting it all. And for a small budget picture, it was kind of ambitious.
Well, it's not an emergency. Should I wear the sweater?
And the actors had to be awfully good to get it right. And I don't know how many times we did it, but we didn't do it too many times. We couldn't do anything too many times. And this is where we tried to give some sense of the boy's troubled nature. Trying to talk to her, couldn't quite talk to her. She didn't know what was the matter, of course, and was not too sensitive to his mood, but then how could she be? I remember I found Tim O'Kelly. He just came in to read for me. It was just like that, like everybody. He's just an actor that came in to read, and I liked him and cast him. We got along very well. He was wonderful to work with. The girl was a blonde, which I guess is a predilection of mine. I didn't realize it at the time. But there she is. The ubiquitous blonde. And then you hear the dialogue of them saying goodbye and so on. And we did a lot of that where you hear offstage dialogue while something else is going on. It's a way of, it's like an economical way of telling the story. I thought, and I still think, that the sound and the picture should do different things. Which is why I decided not to use, another reason I didn't use a score, I thought there's no reason to... If we can tell the story visually, then there's no reason for the music to tell you what to feel or to underscore it, so to speak, underline it, but rather let the music be a kind of counterpoint. Now you look at this, it's still the same shot. It began a few minutes ago. It's still the same shot, comes down the hallway with him, and back into the room. It still hasn't cut. And it's still Regis Philbin and Joey Bishop. Until it goes to the commercial, and then we actually created the commercial.
Well, isn't he silly?
I'm Bush.
So am I.
What do you need your car
I'll
for?
I'll be happy when that bazaar is over.
That actor playing the father is James Brown, whom I had seen in a couple of Howard Hawks movies, and he came in, and I said, let's use him. It was a kind of a tip of the hat to Howard Hawks. He was in Air Force, and I think he was in a couple of Hawks pictures. Now, right after the boy here's the first time we hear about the brother, the only time we hear about, and the father being sort of insistent. Now, this was a trick here, because I had Bobby sit here too long before he got up, and I had to find an exact frame, but it's actually a jump cut here, which nobody's ever noticed, and I worked at it for about 3 days to find a place, because it was too long. And you can see it. I remember looking at his finger, and the only thing you see that jumps is his finger, right there. And nobody's ever noticed it. But that's a jump cut. We took about 30 seconds out because he sat there too long. And this is how this shot ends, as it began over here. And there's the cut. Boom. Right here. And this was shot at the same place where the house is outside in the valley. Oh, we had to do a lot of research on guns to know what was a 38 and a 45 and a 22 and all that. I've forgotten most of it, but this is the only time I really did a gun movie. Now, what you see now coming up is this is the only time where you see the line, because we couldn't afford to mat it in. It was a panning shot. It was too expensive. But then we matted in the other shots of the TV set. This, again, another pan to tell you that we're back again with Karloff. There's a little bit of a delay before you get to him so that you can see he's been drinking. And also to prepare the audience that we're back now with this story. This is a shot from Karloff's first important role in a movie called The Criminal Code, directed by Howard Hawks, whom I knew at this point. I'd known him for 6 years and had interviewed him and done a retrospective of his work at the Museum of Modern Art, which we talk about. We talk about Hawks.
Who is that tapping at my chamber door?
And when he says, who's that tapping at my chamber door, that's, of course, a reference, it's a quote from Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven. It was an inside joke, since he did, I think, two versions of The Raven with Boris.
Hey, The Criminal Code.
And this is, again, The Criminal Code. That offstage line, take it easy, I've had too much already, was put in so that they would know that I've been drinking. So I was a little bit insecure about my drunk scene.
Museum of Modern Art.
Smith's wrong.
I said, I saw this at the Museum of Modern Art, which was true. I did see the Museum of Modern Art. I had programmed it as part of a series on Howard Hawks in 1962, the first Howard Hawks retrospective in the United States. And he says, it's my first really important part, and that it was his first important part. This movie came out the same year as Frankenstein, which you can hardly recognize him in Frankenstein. But this is a good shot, too. The small camera move here. Oh, I cut away from it.
I was supposed to call her.
Why didn't you? Well?
In the original Hawks, this is all one shot. I kind of felt bad about cutting it up, but it was all one shot from where Karloff comes in. And we augmented the sound by turning it up a bit. We made Karloff's name Byron Orlock, so Boris Karloff. It sounds like him. Sounds like the same name, but it's different. And now we go to a car commercial, which in L.A. gets a big laugh.
He really knows how to tell a story.
Now look at this.
Indeed he does.
When Carlos Carlos says, indeed he does, that was his line. He ad-libbed that line. I said, let's keep it in, because I had the line. He knows how to tell a story. Now here...
All the good movies have been made.
That line, all the good movies have been made, it was how I really felt. At that time, and still do. So it was a comment on a movie history comment. Some critics said this was the first time that there was a quote from a movie in a movie in an American film. I don't know if that's true, but maybe it was the first time.
Days to convince Marshall. A work of art.
I was felt a little insecure about playing this drunk scene because I had never been drunk. So, wasn't thrilled with it, but Boris was all right. He was encouraging.
Still, for three lousy, terrible, lousy scripts we did, and finally...
I did quite a few takes of myself on this.
And you quit.
I haven't even read the damn thing.
Well, why not?
The part I played in this actually was written for a friend of mine who's been in a lot of my movies, George Morfogan, later, a very good actor, who's you could see on Oz of late. But he couldn't come out, so it was between Henry Jaglom and me, who was also a friend of mine, and Henry never forgave me for not casting him in it. I said, well, I played it myself. He says, yeah, I know, I should have played it. Anyway, so it's a joke between us.
These days, old-fashioned, outmoded.
This speech,
and
he says, when he puts himself down, Boris had, this is one of the things Boris had complained about to me. He said, well, you know.
Savvy, what's the use? Mr. Boogeyman.
Mr. Boogeyman. King of Blood, they used to call me. All this was about Karloff, of course. But we didn't want to call him Karloff. That would have been. That would have been distracting. But Orlok is close enough.
I couldn't even play a straight part decently.
And he says, I've got bad. And he said, if I say all these terrible things about myself, he said, do I have to do that? And I said, well, Boris, I think the more you put yourself down, the more the audience will say, no, no, it's not true, it's not true. And he said, well, all right. And, of course, this was what gave us the idea, Youth Kill Six in the Supermarket. We had an idea once for a sequence in a supermarket when we were going to have Boris play the heavy, and he was going to kill people behind a stack of canned peas or something. You know, it was a ridiculous sequence. But we liked the idea of shooting in a supermarket because the floors were good for dollying because of all the linoleum. It ended up as a headline and no sequence in a supermarket. But that's how it goes. This pullback was so that I could fall down. And the Vincent Price joke was, of course, based on the fact that Karloff and Vincent Price both did horror pictures with Roger Corman.
Come on, come on. You'll be more comfortable on the couch. Get up.
It was wonderful to act with Karloff. We did this in one or two takes. He was just terrific.
I'm very drunk. Hey, that's my bed.
And Boris, in fact, did need the cane. That was his own cane. He had a brace on both legs, one brace on each leg. As you saw in a couple of the shots, you can see his leg is, one of the legs is rather badly deformed.
Oh, good Lord. I'm as drunk as he is. Sorry.
Oh. Yeah, I think I'm the only man who can claim to have been on a bed, at least, with Boris Karloff. And then it goes to black, which it did. And then we go to black. And this was a very difficult sequence to light for Laszlo. I can't remember how he did it, but it was very tricky because of the only light is really coming from the lit cigarette. And it's all shown from his point of view again. Everything you see, his weird behavior, was meant to throw you off. And this is, of course, just before the first killing.
Leave the light off.
Bobby?
Yeah.
Why are you still up?
Please leave the light off.
Why aren't you asleep yet?
I have a headache.
You know what time it is?
Don't forget the hall light.
We don't really tell you what's happened, but the audience is supposed to feel very uneasy through all this. Which is not difficult since he's
honestly, why can't we turn off the light?
Acting very strangely, and it's not until the end of the sequence do we see the gun that we saw him bring in. And this, of course, is just before the murder of the wife, but it happens in the morning. So we shot the whole picture, as I said, in all of Garlow's stuff in 5 days, and the rest of it was shot in 18 days. So, and 12 of those days were nights at the drive-in. So actually all of this stuff was shot in 6 days. Everything else, I don't know how. But we were going fast, that's for sure. Here's one shot coming up from her point of view of him. Strange shot. Difficult to make. It's a little too bright on her. The timing in this print is a little too bright on her. It's hard to get this right.
Well, aren't you going to go to sleep?
I just want to finish a cigarette.
Okay.
Well, the weird thing about this movie was that we shot it in 1967, and the following year, we shot it in April of 67. The following year, Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy were both killed, and there was suddenly a hue and cry about guns before this movie was released, even though, there's the gun, even though we had shot it beforehand. That close-up, D-I-E, that was Sammy Fuller's idea to begin the sequence like that. This is a scary sequence. The first murder. Horrible sequence. The car the boy drives and the rifle he uses were both the same as the killer of Martin Luther King. People have said this sequence is a bit strangely nightmarish and dreamlike. Well, it is. It's. He's obviously a good marksman, and it's a bit Fritz Langian in its kind of banality. And we did some after the shooting, which was all done in pieces, and was quite shocking to an audience. Then we did quite a few things in long takes, the cleaning up, so to speak, ending with another very ambitious shot, which we'll get to in a minute. But this is picking her up and carrying her down. All this was done in one piece. And what he does here, putting the dead bodies in the bed and covering them up kind of neatly, is what Charles Whitman had done. And it's all one shot here, you see. It's what Whitman had done. He killed his mother, I think, and his wife and a couple of other people in his house, and then he put them neatly to bed and covered their eyes and sort of just what Whitman did is what the boy does here. All very normal. And closing the doors and all that was what he had done. Everything was found very neat. And which is where we got the idea of him covering up the blood and covering up the traces of the murder. That clock is to remind you of the time, which we're going to, when we go to Karloff again, we start on the clock, which was planned so that you'd know that it was all in around the same time. This is a tricky shot. Go to the curve there. Again, putting the mother to bed, this was not easy. Lifting her and putting her in bed. And it was all, again, part of this thing that Whitman had done. That was what we based most of the characters. In fact, there's two or three lines, which I'll tell you when we get to, that are directly what Charles Whitman said. This was such a strange sequence to shoot, and I think we have the ice cream truck and all these different sound effects. A lot of the action sequences in this, particularly the ones outside, but even here, were done without much sound or no sound. And Verna Fields, who was the sound editor on this picture, very inventively found an awful lot of wonderful sounds that she put in. Like the ice cream truck, I think, is in here. There was a lot of extraordinary sound work that she did, which is what gave me the idea to use her as a film editor, which she did for me on What's Up, Doc. Now, this is a tricky, very, very, again, a rather ambitious and difficult shot, where we suddenly take over and the point of view of the director takes over, and you don't quite know what's happening. Pan, and then, oh, there's a cut, right? And this was very hard, because it shows sort of the remains of what he left behind, and ends up on the note. And in those days, it was not very easy to focus, so we were all praying that when we got to the note, it would be in focus, and there was no way to tell until we saw the dailies, really. And the music you hear, again, you hear him drive, getting in the car, driving away, all that was to avoid having to show it. We thought we'd do two things at once. And here's the note. And I remember when we saw the dailies, we said, yeah, it's in focus, except that to whom it may concern. But, and the original title of the movie was Before I Die. That was the original title, but we didn't like it and we changed it to Targets. And so this is to show that it's just a couple of minutes after, and you see the book on top is Renoir, a little tip of the hat to Renoir, if you can catch it. Jean Renoir as opposed to the painter, but the book was about the painter, but it was for Jean Renoir, who liked this movie very much when he saw it. And this was a tricky scene because in the script it said I was supposed to see him, which I do now, and then jump and then start laughing.
I was having a nightmare. I opened my eyes.
And I couldn't laugh on cue. And we did about four takes, and I couldn't laugh, and I kept screwing it up. And Boris Karloff said, well, you know, just because you wrote that you have to laugh doesn't mean you really do have to laugh. I mean, you wrote it. You can also ignore it. I said, you're right. So I ignored it and didn't laugh, and then we got the take. And now Boris does a take on the mirror, which was his idea. He said, what if I do a little take here? And that always got a huge laugh in the theater when we were shown. This scene with Nancy... The hangover scene.
Not so loud.
Where she gives him the tickets.
Suite on the Super Chief to Chicago.
And where he talks about the Super Chief, the 20th century, and then the Queen Elizabeth. All that was ways that people in those days, even in those days, most people didn't travel that way, but rich people and certainly older people did. Was written, this absolutely written by Sammy Fuller. He just dictated it to me, or just he ad-libbed it to me, and I wrote it down. Because in the original version, Karloff's character was killed off in the halfway through the picture, because we only had him for 2 days at first, and then finally 5 days.
Here last night.
He had a guest. Boy, you just made my headache worse. You can do that.
But Sammy said, why are you killing him off halfway through the picture? I said, well, I can't afford to have him. He said, that's no reason. He said, don't ever think about budget. Never think about budget. Write it the way you want it. And then, of course, he came up with the ending that we used, Sammy Fuller did, which I'll talk to you about when I get to. God, it was a joy to work with Boris Karloff. He was such a pro.
This is Jenny. I have good news for you. And then Byron's going to do the drive-in.
He's going to do the drive-in, and then you go to the drive-in. Again, this was all planned, but Sammy Fuller did most of the rewriting on this in terms of keeping Karloff alive. This was shot in the valley on a crane. I don't know how we were on a big platform shooting. I don't know how we got permission to do this, but there we were in the middle of the street. And this is the famous San Fernando Valley. See, that bike almost got... He almost hit that bike because I told him to turn as quickly as possible. And again, another gun shop, a real gun shop, which is what you see in a second, was really there. And we shot in the gun shop. And we got permission to shoot in the gun shop by gun shops by not showing them at the scripts, because they wouldn't have let us shoot it in if we'd shown it to them. So we told them it was about a boy who goes hunting with his father. And it shows their very close relationship because they go hunting on weekends. It's a complete lie.
Hi, Roy.
Hiya.
Could I have 300 rounds of the 30-06?
Okay.
Oh, and the box of the 12 gauge.
What size?
$4.
Good bit of shooting. Anything else?
Nope.
Okay. How's your dad?
It's okay.
Damn flu going around. Spent the day in bed yesterday. The whole day.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Could you charge that to my dad?
I'll check.
I was shocked at the thought that this kid could just, any kid could just go around and buy all these guns. Look at all these guns and just walk in and get. Did some research, and there's Targets, there's the title. That's not where we got the idea, though. We were trying to come up with a title, and we couldn't come up with anything, and we didn't like Before I Die. It sounded like some picture we'd already seen. And then I remember we were sitting around the pool at my parents' house in Scottsdale, and Polly said, how about Human Targets? And I said, how about Targets? And that's how we got the title. And then realized that the title was in the picture.
Sign here, Bob.
Oh, something you didn't notice it when we were shooting it.
Going out with his dad again?
Now this line when he says, what are you going to hunt this time? And the boy says, I'm going to shoot some pigs.
What you hunting this time? I'm going to shoot some pigs.
That is exactly what Whitman said when he bought some ammunition just before he went and shot all the people in Texas. He said, we're going to shoot some pigs. This actor, Sandy Baron, who died recently, was a comic actor that I worked with in New York. I directed him in something I had done in the theater in New York. And he was a very good actor, very good at comedy, and I liked him very much. We were friends. I lost touch with him, but this was written for him.
Is that beautiful?
All right, come on, let's go on.
Hey, man.
This whole sequence here of asking questions that leads to the story that Karloff tells came about because I had heard Boris do the narration for Chuck Jones's feature-length version of How the Grinch Stole Christmas, which was on television just around the time we were preparing this film. And he narrated it absolutely beautifully. And I thought, how can I do a movie with Boris Karloff and not have him tell a story in it? Because he tells stories so well. He recorded the Rudyard Kipling's Just So stories, and as I said, he did this wonderful narration of How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
Dull, deadly dull. It's going to be my...
Yeah, so that's where it came with me saying, well, tell him the story.
Yeah. Hey, what are you cats talking about?
Why don't you tell him a story? You know, a few scary stories.
Yes, I might perhaps do that.
And then I had read this, story he does tell about the appointment in Samara is from a play by Somerset Maugham, but it's used as the kind of epigram at the beginning of John O'Hara's novel, Appointment in Samara. And that's where I took it from.
Story to think about as you drive home through the darkness.
And there's a line about I like to have a pin spot
many
on me.
Many years ago, there should be a pin spot to where I see on my face as I'm talking.
Now, this shot that you're going to see now, when the camera goes back there, the wide shot here, we did exactly a half a take because we had to fly that table that was in the way. That table had to move without it making any noise, and they screwed it up. In the first take. This was done at about 1 o'clock in the morning. I think it was the second to last day of shooting or the last day of shooting. So we got to about halfway through it and they screwed up the table, so we had to go back and start again. And this is, in fact, the only completed take of this shot, which began in the back in the wide shot and moves into a close-up and ends in a close-up of Boris. This was the only completed take. And it was done around 1:30 in the morning, as I say, on a little stage in Santa Monica. And I asked him beforehand, I said, it's a long story. I said, do you want to have it written out somewhere? He says, you mean idiot cards? And I said, well, yeah. He said, no. He says, I have the lyrics. And I said to him, just before we shot it, came over to him, I whispered in his ear, I said, at the end of the shot, Boris, after you tell the story, let the character think about dying himself. And he said, all right. And he does this wonderful moment at the end. After he does the story, when he does this moment right here.
In Samara.
Just this moment thinking about himself dying. And that was it. And when he finished that shot, that's the only completed take, the crew spontaneously burst into applause. It still moves me to think about it. And he was touched, I could see. He smiled and nodded. And his wife, Evie Karloff, was on the set. And I walked over to her, and she had tears in her eyes. She was wiping her eyes. And she said, can you imagine how many years it's been since the crew applauded for Boris? And it was a wonderful moment. I never forgot it, of course. And it's one of my favorite moment in the whole picture. This sequence, overlooking the freeway, the 405, I think, Laszlo and I went out. This sort of strange collection of, looks like sets that you see in front of you right there. They were there. They were really there. I don't know what it was. It looks like it was the remains of some kind of parade or something. I don't know what it was. All that was really there. And we got lucky. And we shot this. It was all actually, this was exactly the location. When you see the freeway in the background, that's where it was. Laszlo and I went out a few days before we shot this. And I told him, in order to save time, I told him every single setup, because I had planned it, so that we could move quickly from one shot to the next. So we knew when we got there what every setup was going to be. There's a lot of shots in this sequence. We did this entire sequence that you're seeing here, everything, including the freeway and all this, in two days. And there's, I don't know how many setups. Just a lot, including this dolly shot and a few other shots. Like, they were not exactly easy. Everything was shot in 2 days. And of course, everything that you see on the freeway, which you'll see quite a bit of, was shot illegally. Because you're not allowed, not only are you not allowed to shoot on the freeway, which you're not allowed to shoot at the freeway. Worse, we staged accidents on the freeway. You're definitely not allowed to do that. But all this was shot in the real locations. None of this was storyboarded. It was all worked out. It was written in the script this way. Each shot pretty much was written in the script. Then I went out and because we'd looked at the locations, and then we went out and... Oh, and as you see that long shot, the wide shot you saw of the tanks, didn't go to that until right at the end of the sequence, right at the end of him getting him up on the tanks. Hitchcock had told me, he says, never use establishing shots to establish. Only use them when you want a dramatic effect. So, of course, I saved it to the end of the sequence. As per Mr. Hitchcock's advice. All this was really done on the tanks overlooking this freeway. I think it's the 405. And this laying down of the guns, this was hell to cut because it was, we did about four angles and we had them laid out and I had to speed it up a little bit, so we did cutaways, but we had to wait till he looked because it's all his point of view. And there's a lot of tricking around to get it laid out because it took too long. Once I was in the cutting room, I realized you have to smarten it up, as my old acting teacher Stella Adler used to say, smarten it up, darling. So we put in a few cutaways just to make it move a little quicker. But it took me quite a while to edit this. But it was all shot, as I said, in 2 days. I don't know how. Including everything you see that's going to happen on the freeway. But another piece of advice I'd gotten from another director, Howard Hawks, helped me a lot here. He said, always cut on movement, and then the audience won't see the cut. So, as long as he was moving, we could get away with a lot of things. Even shortening things and mismatching and so on, because there was movement. Now, this sequence, every single sound you hear, from the time the car drove up to this scene, the time he got out of the car and to the, where this sequence ends, every single sound that you hear was put in by Verna Fields because we shot this silent. We couldn't afford to have a sound crew. Even that little, I never forget that Coke bottle when he opened it up and it went, I had asked her to put that in because he did a double opening and I wanted to have that sound of the before it quite opens fully. That was all the sound, which is hard to believe. Is none of the sound here is natural sound. It's all put in afterward by Verna. I think we had 28 sound reels to mix for this sequence. She did a brilliant job of getting it all right. Every little sound was added afterward. Now, all the crosshairs shots here were shot, I mean, were added, of course, later. But, in other words, we shot with a long lens, we did the shot, and then in the lab, we put the crosshairs in. Now, it was so difficult to do that they attempted to do it for me twice, and I rejected it from the lab. And they finally said, okay, Peter, you come in and do it yourself. So actually, I did it frame by frame, put it in, because it had to be exactly at a certain place when he shot. The crosshairs had to be on the people when they got shot, and it was very difficult to do it, so we had to do it frame by frame, and I did it myself. That's Danny Selznick in the back there, who just got shot. He's the associate producer on the picture. It was the first film he ever worked with. He's David O. Selznick's son. He grew up in the business, but he wasn't going to be in the business. You hear the breath he takes just before he shoots. That was all put in later. All this was put in afterwards. It was all done silent. And the crosshairs, I remember having to move it frame by frame. Now that is Robert Walker Jr.'s wife. The barrel being hot was something Sammy Fuller told me to put in, because he said the barrel would be hot because he knew about guns. Now, she actually was doing that on the freeway. This is totally against the law. She was signaling for the people to stop and so on. And we had walkie-talkies between the car and us, and that's how we cued all the people. Okay, we're on Sherman Way East, we're coming up, we're driving closer, okay, here we come, there we are, okay, we see you. And that's how we, you know, we see him, okay, now shoot, now react, now fall. All that was done with walkie-talkies. It was rather elaborate. Again, this thing, all this was very elaborate, and we did it, as I said, in 2 days, all this. Kind of shocking. Now he shoots him with this, and we did that with a dummy. It was the only way to do that shot. The little tip of the hat to Fritz Lang. Oh, that's a real police car. And Laszlo says, here comes a police car. And I said, shoot it. I said, that's a real police motorcycle. But they didn't know they were being shot. We're not allowed to shoot. Now, this shot, this little pan, and then you see him running around below, was inspired by a similar shot from North by Northwest, of course, when he runs out of the UN building, which was actually done as a matte shot. It wasn't painted, but ours was real. And this... what looks like blood there was, I swear we didn't put that in, it was just there. And I said, well, let's show it, what the hell. Since it's a horror picture, I might as well go for it. I have to tell you the truth, I don't like horror pictures. My two least favorite kinds of movies are horror pictures and science fiction. So, of course, my first movie is a horror picture. And I never made another one. It's really more of a thriller than a horror picture, actually. There's one shot. He goes piling by, and then this was a police car that we controlled to do this pan. I don't know if Hitchcock saw this movie. I don't remember discussing it with him. He never talked about my pictures much. We talked about his. The idea of having the music go in and out only when you cut to him, I thought would work very effectively, even though we only had access to five records. The two fellas I knew that let me use the five records, I think we paid $5,000 to use five records or something. It was a ridiculously small amount of money, but that's all we had. And so all the music you hear is from five records. God, I used every fraction of it that I could. It wasn't great music, but it worked as a kind of sound effect, cutting in and out, and I thought it would work that way. Of course, I would have been happier if I could have used music that was famous from this era, but we couldn't afford it. Easy Rider, which was made after a year and a half later, used the same idea. And there's Frank Marshall, the producer of and director of many films, playing the drive-in ticket boy. He comes in later again. Easy Rider, which was made a year or two later, but they used Laszlo Kovacs and Paul Lewis, the associate producer of our picture. They borrowed my whole crew and also took the idea of using records, but they could afford to have some really good records and use some wonderful music in that picture. But I think we were the first ones to just use records and no score. Of course, Hitchcock had done similar thing in Rear Window, but he didn't use records. He had actually a little bit of scoring done by Franz Waxman. That was, we did this at dusk on the same day, the first day of shooting. The same day we shot Boris in the limousine, in the morning sequence. We shot this that same day, and they went and changed into different clothes. And we only had the limousine for one day. And we weren't allowed to shoot in front of the Beverly Hills Hotel, so we went and shot somewhere that sort of looked a little bit like the Beverly Hills Hotel. Like this shot, too, it gives you a feeling of Beverly Hills. It was, in fact, shot near the Beverly Hills Hotel. And this sequence at the drive-in, which begins here, the night sequence at the drive-in, was a very complicated sequence, which we spent, out of our 23-day shooting schedule, we spent 12 days here, 12 nights, 12 sort of half days and nights here. And Sammy Fuller had given me a very good piece of advice. He said, save your money for the finish, kid. And so we did. And really, almost half the picture was shot in this sequence, which is very elaborate. And was written pretty much the way it was shot. If you look at the script, you'll see a lot of the shots were in the script. We also made some tests of the refreshment stand and did some things with natural light. Now, Polly Platt's going to walk by right now, and she's pregnant with my first daughter. Here she comes. She's going to walk past with our first daughter, Antonia, in her belly. I think it's here. There she goes. That was her. Rather quick. I never forgot it, though. We didn't have money for extras, so we used everybody. This was the Reseda drive-in. Everything was shot there. Some extras we had. We had some extras. And actually, they weren't extras. They were friends of ours. They were friends of, you know, like a fellow that owned the Larry Edmonds bookshop, Melville Bavisky, and a guy named John Resco, who wrote a book that Ben Gazzara acted in called Reprieve. He was there. And, oh, just a lot of friends came down. And we had some actors who then played people who got shot. This guy was a real projectionist. His name was Byron, of all things. And he was the real projector. Now, this refreshment stand was a test we did. These were all real people. And we went and did a test last night to see how it would, there was no additional lighting there. And of course, we used it in the picture. We had to use everything. This was real. This was actually at the drive-in with people walking by, and we had a few extras. I don't think we had extras. I think they were just friends. And there's Frank Marshall putting that in place. That's Polly's hand, I remember that. And he was a real projectionist, of course, and worked at the drive-in, and we shot all this in the projection booth. All this threading, of course, he did himself. He was a nice old man. Then he had to get shot later, and he did all that himself. This was a test shot. We used it. And these shots were all test shots to see how it would look without any additional light. All the shots you see at dusk were shot at dusk. We did them over a period of a few nights. As I said, we were there for 12 days. So we grabbed what we could. That was a test shot, too, that we just did to see how it would look when we went out there a few times, once or twice, to grab a few shots. These were actors getting paid very little. And this was all scripted. And the kid in the, that was, we, somebody brought their baby, so we said, let's put that in this. This was a test shot, another test shot. These were a few extras that we had. Yeah, we had about maybe 10, and trying to make them look like 25. That guy, Paul Condillis, in the tuxedo, he was a radio personality. This was another test shot. He was a radio personality in Los Angeles. And you'll see him, that's Polly's voice saying it's starting. He was a radio personality who interviewed me for a couple of articles, and then we used him in What's Up, Doc? He plays the waiter in the scene where the place catched on fire. That all the sound here, all this music, is from the Terra. I think that was the AIP logo. That's the guy there, Mel Lubomirski and his wife. He was the owner of the famous Larry Edmonds bookshop. Still there on Hollywood Boulevard. These are actors kissing. And these shots of the drive-in screen at night with the movie projected on it, we did afterward with a miniature. It cost $250 to build the miniature. Roger was very annoyed at me for spending $250 on the miniature screen. And we projected it with front projection with a 16-millimeter projector. Laszlo's idea of how to do this, because it was very difficult. Because as you see now, the camera moves in while the cutting is going on. There's a slow dolly shot in. We did that in the studio. All this was done on the soundstage with a miniature. And the film projected in 16 and the dolly moving in. I think we had a dolly shot. Moving in, it was carefully timed. I thought with the dolly and the cutting of the thing it would work. I think it was a dolly shot that moved into a zoom shot. And then we went to the real location once you get in very deep into it. Right here we cut. And that was really behind the screen at the Reseda drive-in. And this was a very difficult shot, this kind of crane up, which was done, I can't remember his name, Ramsey, came up with how to do this. It was done with some kind of a pulley system in order to get this shot, because there was no way we could get a crane in there. And I wanted to sort of discover him, which we do right here. And so we had to do it with some kind of a pulley system, people actually pulling the camera up like on a portable, like almost like an elevator. It was man-made elevator, handmade. That was this was again with the 16-millimeter on a miniature. Oh, this was a memorable moment. We shot the shots of of course, without Boris. But when he arrived from London, he said to me, he says, you know, that line, God, what an ugly town this has become. Before we shot that, he said to me, you have written the truest line I've ever read in a motion picture. I said, what? He says, I was reminded of it when I arrived today in Los Angeles. I said, what line is that? God, what an ugly town this has become. I said, my God, really? that was his favorite line in the picture. At least he said it was the most true line he'd ever read. These are all actors sitting in their cars for this dolly shot. I also have to say that I hated drive-in theaters, and I must say I think we probably managed to help close a few. Because of the people, there are people who told me they saw this film in a drive-in, and they said it was the scariest thing they've ever seen, sitting in a drive-in seeing this movie. I had had the idea way back in the very, like, 1961, when I was working at the New Yorker Theater in New York, which Dan Talbot owned. I had had the idea of having somebody shoot somebody through a screen, not a drive-in screen, but a screen. Now that actor there, getting into the phone booth, is Mike Farrell, who became famous on MASH. This was one of his first pictures. You'll recognize him a little bit when you get closer later. He gets shot here. And this zoom in there, the shot, was an idea I took from something Fritz Lang said to me. When I had said to him, we had discussed the zoom lens, and he said he didn't like the zoom lens. And I said, what would you ever use it for? And he said, well, maybe for a bullet. And so I borrowed that, or I actually stole the idea from Fritz Lang and used it quite a few times in this, where the zoom becomes a bullet. This was shot one very long night at the drive-in with Boris. That's all we had Boris at the drive-in was one night. Got to be about midnight, and I said, this is going to take a little longer. He says, all right, it's all right, it's all right. We went till about 3 in the morning with him. He was so sweet. He never complained, and it was cold, as it always is in L.A. at night.
We're just waiting for Mr. Larkin.
Oh, Sam hasn't come yet, has he, Ed?
No.
Well, then we'll just go up front and watch.
All right. When you go in, just turn around and go all the way up to the front, up by the screen.
But the idea of having somebody shoot somebody from behind the screen... I had very early on, as I said, but I couldn't figure out how to, except with a silencer, how people in the theater wouldn't hear it. Of course, in the drive-in, it works because you don't hear that much in the drive-in if you have the sound up in your ear. This person who gets shot here, again with the zoom shot, was... Elaine Partnow, who has edited some very fine anthologies about women's quotes and so on. She became a writer. Again, the only sound you hear is the shooting and the sound of the movie. And it's all from the same movie, The Terror. Now, these people were kissing, and we could hardly get them to stop kissing. To do the scene. They were enjoying the kissing so much.
Oh, there's somebody shooting out here. Open the window.
Has anyone else except yourself?
It looks like the window breaks when we do the zoom, but actually it's a cheat. They didn't break. It just looks like they did. can't remember how we did it, but we tricked it somehow. Here's Mike Farrell crawling to the car. So you can hardly see him, but it was, in fact, one of the first things he did. He's very good in the scene, as a matter of fact. I knew he was a good actor, and I think I maybe saw him once. Since then, that's what our gypsy life is like. As I said earlier, this was all planned very carefully, this the film running out and the changeover. There's the changeover, which you have to know, you have to be a film buff to know about. And getting the crosshairs exactly in the right place and taking a breath. Well, I knew that because I used to shoot in camp. The sound going up.
Somebody's drunk.
Careful. Blow your window down!
That was Frank Marshall's girlfriend at the time. Mm-hmm. All these shots from The Terror, of course, were just pulled out of sequence for what would be good. He starts to go down the stairs, so we pan down. It was all...
What? I can't hear.
That's Frank Marshall's father and mother right there.
There's a sniper here.
They both died. Father died quite young during Daisy Miller. All these shots were very tricky to do, and Laszlo was brilliant at figuring out how we were going to do it. This is a test shot. This is one of the spookier shots in the picture. The kid is crying and pans over and you see that his father's been shot, and then there's another shot rings out and he stops crying, and that was the dolly grip you see with a bullet in his throat. This was one of the more disgusting shots where you don't see the kid but you know he gets shot. It certainly made the audience very quiet during that. uh all these shots of people leaving, of course, there weren't. We didn't have many cars. It just looked like we did. There's Frank, and that was Danny Selznick yelling out. This was funny, Karloff looking at the people and saying, they seem to be loving it. Everybody's driving out of the car. I found this stuff the most difficult to do, just driving a car and then later running. Running was more difficult even than driving. Because your tendency is to want to act driving, and you just have to drive. I played most of this on Frank because I hated my performance in this scene.
Is Mr. Orlock here yet?
I played most of it on Frank because I didn't like myself in the scene.
Okay, thanks.
So I stayed on Frank. This high shot was done actually at the drive-in when everybody was leaving. Because we didn't have that many cars. It had to be faked. And here's poor Byron lying on the floor in the projections. I think the filmmaker has a responsibility, and we tried to show this with some responsibility. It wasn't too bloody. It was very important to show that he was running out of ammunition and running out of weapons. Otherwise, there was no way to apprehend him. So we kept showing him losing guns and losing ammunition. All this was an attempt to set up the ending that he runs out of bullets finally. And then he loses all the bag of weapons falls. Otherwise it would be unbelievable. These shots when he looks down and were actually shot in reverse and shooting up, because there was no way to do it any other way. This actor, Jay Daniel, became a producer. He produced the Sybil Show years later. And he was quite a well-known television producer. And I met him, and I said, "You look awfully familiar." He put on a few pounds, and he said, "Yeah, I was the kid that finds the dead body in Targets." I said, "My God, Jay Daniel." This was actually shot backstage at the drive-in, inside the screen. If you ever wondered what a drive-in screen looks like inside, it's real.
Where are you? Where are you? Turn out those lights!
Turn those lights off! Why doesn't Bill kill this shot? He's not moving.
My God, it's true then.
Turn the lights off. I'm calling the police.
Get Orlock out of there.
I like that. Get Orlock out of it and dissolves to the thing. Now he's trying to find the weapons. And somebody said this looks like a shot in Strangers on a Train when he's trying to get the lighter. And I guess it is like it. This was very difficult running. I found myself acting running. You have to just run. Laszlo did a great job with all these red lights and so on. And that shot of the somebody else with guns was, again, a kind of a comment on the easy accessibility of guns in America, which is, I think, a tragic situation. And nothing much has changed since I made this movie 34, almost 35 years ago. It's still awfully easy to get guns. And we thought maybe this might have some kind of impact after all, but it didn't. We show the film running out because the film, of course, does run out eventually, just at the end.
That man has a rifle.
The ending originally was different, of course, because Karloff was killed earlier, and because of Sammy, who had a much better idea, we changed it. But Sammy said to me, he said, have you got any shots of Karloff? He said, have you got any shots of Karloff in the other movie, in a tuxedo? And I said, yeah, there is some. He says, great, I hear what you do. And that's where he gave me the idea, Sammy Fuller, of having Karloff approaching the killer, both on the screen and in life, which is a marvelous conceit that I think we pulled off, but it was Sammy Fuller's idea.
There he is.
And we were lucky that there was a shot of Karloff in the Terror in a tuxedo. And that's how we did, that's where we got the idea for the ending, from Samuel Fuller. All this quick cutting I did on a little moviola on Sadakor Street in the San Fernando Valley. It took me 6 months to edit the picture. I did it by, there's no editor credit on the picture because I didn't want to take credit for everything, writing, directing, and all that, and editing. So there is no editor credit on the picture, but actually I did it myself every frame by hand on the old-fashioned moviola, which is, it's much easier now with a computer, that's for sure. And we shot this actually again on the miniature, shooting up at it with that tilted angle. We just did it. It was Sammy's idea. And the film running out, all this was planned this way. And that's the only time you see them in the shot together. In the two stories converge in that one shot where he slaps them. That's the only time you see them together in the entire movie. Just for those few seconds.
You okay, Mr. Warlock?
I think this was, in fact, the last thing we shot with Boris. Either that or it was the first day. People ask me, what does that mean? Is that what I was afraid of? And I said, well, it means he was afraid of modern horror, and that's what it was. And he's a scared kid, was the implication. Of course, modern horror is a lot more than a scared kid. But maybe that's what it boils down to. This line here, I hardly ever missed it, I was not something Whitman said, and I thought it would be unrepentant, so I put that in. We screened the picture for Boris, about a year after we shot it, and it was about 7 or 8 months before he died, and he and Evie, his last wife, came and saw it. There's the embrace. The director embraces the girl in a long shot. And anyway, Boris and Evie saw it, and they really liked the picture, and they were very complimentary and always referred to it as Boris's last picture. And even though he actually did shoot some other stuff, this was again a test shot that we dissolved into. And this shot here, which is actually the last shot in the picture, Laszlo and I were sitting on top of the drive-in screen all by ourselves a few days after we finished the movie. We went out, put the car there, and got this one last shot. And as we were shooting, a cloud came in, as you see it moving now, and started to cover the area. And I said, wow, look at the clouds coming in. Laszlo, I said, let's keep shooting. And we shot and shot and shot and shot and shot. And I just let, and the film actually ran out. And it almost covers the whole area, this cloud. I don't think it quite finished covering it before the film ran out. And Lazo said, oh, damn it, ran out. I said, well, we'll make it work. And it was just, yeah, there it goes. That's just before it actually ran out. That was the end of the picture. So, as John Ford would say, we got lucky with that one.